began to think about the book of Ruth, I thought about the movie Inception. You know, we're not going to give any spoilers. You should have seen it by now. It's a great movie. But it's the dream within a dream within a dream, right? The layers going down. How do you plant a thought in someone's mind so they know what they thought? They think it's their thought. So a dream within a dream within a dream. Oh, we come to Ruth. It's not so much a dream, but it's a story. Story of Ruth within a story within a story. There's layers here that we need to be aware of. It begins in verse 1, we see, in the days of the judges. We've seen that. We heard that backstory last week. But the whole book ends, the very last word in chapter 4, verse 22, is the word David. David. The genealogy leading up, the very last word of the book, David. In the Judges, but in the time of David. So we know this has something to do with David. That's the larger story that Ruth is a part of. It's leading someplace. But it also takes into account the story that's happened up to this point, particularly what we find in Genesis chapter 12, where God makes a covenant with Abraham. He says, I'm going to bless you that you may be a blessing to the nations, and that all the nations will be blessed through you. And we begin to see a little seed of that because you have a person of a nation outside of Israel, a Moabite. Ruth is a Moabite. We're going to see that over and over again. The book keeps stressing. She's Ruth the Moabite. She actually comes into Israel and is blessed by Israel's God. So it's the Abrahamic covenant is being fulfilled in a small measure in Ruth's life. That's the story within the story. You got to keep in context Abraham and David. And the book of Matthew leads us then to think about this in terms of Jesus. Matthew 1:1. And no, I know nobody get triggered. We're not starting Matthew again. We're just like, oh my gosh. But the first verse, since it's been a while, does say this. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. He didn't just pick two random names. He picked out two covenantally significant names. This is part of the big story, and the big story finds its completion in Jesus Christ. What's fascinating in that genealogy of Matthew that follows that first verse, Ruth is mentioned specifically by name. It's pretty powerful. But Jesus is the big story that it's leading to. We need to keep that in mind. Otherwise, Ruth simply becomes a nice story, a kind of ancient romantic comedy we can look at. Comedy in the fullest sense of Shakespeare's sense. It's a happy ending, and that's nice. And the characters are simply mere moral examples. Now, they are examples for us. They are examples of covenant loyalty, faithfulness, obedience. They are that. But they're more than that, because the story is within a story, is within a larger story of Jesus Christ. So this larger context we want to keep in mind. I want to start in verses 1 through 5. We've heard them, just read them. I'm not going to read them again. But I want to tell us, if all we had was verses 1 through 5, we might think this is the beginning actually of a horror story. Really. We might think this is actually the beginning of Judges chapter 22, where there was only 21 chapters we saw last week. Think about it. There's a famine during the time of Judges in this instance. And a famine in the minds of Israel is that that's one of God's covenantal curses. When you turn away from me, God said, and serve other gods, one of the curses I'll bring upon you is famine. There's a famine in the land. There's a man who leaves Israel to go to a foreign land with a foreign god. And this man dies. The sons who are of Israel marry foreign women who are not of Israel. And they die. And there's widows. We think, this is the story. This is the setup for another horror story of Judges that we just got done out of. That horror story of a book at the end, especially. And yet, one author said this, within the span of five short verses, a dark world becomes miserably into focus, looking every bit as anguished, every bit as severe, and every bit as hopeless as the world just encountered in the book of Judges. Now, the good news is that there's some exciting things that are going to happen. This story is going to twist in an amazing good way. It's a happy story. It is a comedy in that sense, not in the comedy like ha-ha comedy, but there is the resolution of what this starts out to be a very desperate situation. Matter of fact, God is faithful to his people because she hears that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food in verse 6. The Lord has done this. She hears God's still active in the land of the judges, still active in that time of darkness. God is still merciful. That gives us hope. Hope that's going to come to life in this book. In verses 6 through 13, we see now these three widows begin a movement back to Israel, back to Bethlehem. And we see in verses 8 and 9, Naomi's words to these two widows that are with her. And Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt kindly with the dead and with me. And may the Lord grant that you may find rest each in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them and they lifted up their voices and wept. This is Naomi's counsel to Orpah and Ruth. I hear that word, and I read it, and I think, I always want to read Oprah. You're reading the books, like, oh, it's Oprah. No, it's Orpah. But I started saying it out loud in my study, going, Orpah. I started thinking of orca. Thought of SeaWorld, thought of dolphins. You know, it's like, my mind went this weird. So, and I did that in my study. So my wife sometimes said, "What is he doing in there?" "I'm studying the Bible." But she gives counsel to Orpah and Ruth. And actually, latent in her words is a very strong view of who God is. Sometimes we don't often think about this. She twice uses the word Lord. "May the Lord deal kindly with you. May the Lord grant you to find rest." What that means, because in the ancient world, they thought of like land. Well, if you lived in the land, you served not only the king that was there, but you also served the god. So, and they would look at, Moabites would look at Israel and say, "Oh, Israel, that's your land. You've got a god. That's Yahweh's land and people. But over here, we're in Moab. And so we're under the god of Chemosh. That's our God. And this is his land, we're people." But Israel's theology said, no, our God created everything. So even if whatever these beings are that you have, whether the demons or whatever, he created them. He created not only our land, he created the heavens and the earth. He owns it all. And so when Naomi is blessing them, the Lord bless you as you go back into Moab. My God has the power to do that. May you be blessed by him. She doesn't invoke their gods. She invokes the God of Israel. It's a subtle thing, but I think it shows a great faith and a deep theology about who the Creator is, even in a dark time. Even in a dark time where they didn't have maybe the clarity of the revelation that other times had. In verses 11 and 13, when she tells them to return, this isn't her trying to shove people away. This is actually very prudential reading. This is wise in her mind. You know, I can't provide for you, Orpah and Ruth, by giving you husbands. You should find rest with a new husband in your land. And think about it. She's looking after their well-being. The promises are not great for a widow. The promises are even more bleak for a foreign widow in Israel. Nobody's marrying foreign widows. And so, but at least you have a chance if you go back to Moab. Be blessed. Find rest in your mother's home. And so, Orpah goes back, as we see in verse 14. They lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. She won't go. And here in this section, in verse 15, Naomi says to her, then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Now in verses 16 and 17, we have Ruth's confession of covenantal allegiance. Ruth's confession of covenantal allegiance is it's a high point of the book. It's a high point of the chapter. It's a high point of the book, I think, as to what she says in response to this. This is a very deeply emotional time, but something deep is happening here. It's not merely personal loyalty, which is good and glorious. If you're in a place of bitterness and pain, you want somebody to stick by you like Ruth is sticking by Naomi. You want a friend like that. You want somebody to enter into your life. But it's more than that, because it's a mention of return to your gods, and Ruth says no. And she clearly says in verse 16 and 17, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. And your people shall be my people, your God, Yahweh, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. And thus may the Lord Yahweh do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." Sort of this oath, this vow unto death. We have oaths like that, right? People stand up here and they look really fancy and pretty and they make oaths, "Until death do us part." But even this, so I won't break this oath. And so Naomi relents. It'd be really bad to keep pressing somebody. They just told you they'd rather die, or they will die if they break their word. So to keep pressing them to break their word would be to say, I want you to die. So she says, okay, she relents. Lets her come. And so this is a conversion. It's a declaration of a conversion. It's a declaration of profound allegiance to Naomi, to Naomi's God, to Naomi's people. Consider the details. She is forsaking her people that she's known all her life. She's forsaking her culture, that's what she's known all of her life, and she's forsaking the gods that she learned about from her mother and father. Chemosh is the big one. Forsaking all of that. She's forsaking all reasonable hope for a husband, children, and a secure future, for that is how women in the ancient Near East, that was their security. Without that, what do you do? She's willing to travel to a land she has not seen or ever been to. The last she heard about it, the reason you came here was a famine. Here there's bread now. She covenantally ties her life to Naomi, including Naomi's God, Yahweh. The language of, we saw in verse 6, do not urge me to leave you, leave. And in verse 14 was this language that she clung to Naomi. Language of clinging, leaving, is the language found in Genesis 2, verse 24, when a man shall leave his father and mother, leave, and then cling to his wife. So we talk about leaving and cleaving. So that kind of, that covenantal, this bondedness, this is my family, this is the orientation of my life, this is what I am now. But she also covenantally ties herself not just to Naomi, but to Naomi's community. This is a subtle thing that happens here. It says in verse 17, where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. She doesn't say, I think I always read it this way, when you die, I'll die. Where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. Now, the idea here is that, you know, Naomi's older. It's a declaration that Naomi probably in all likelihood is going to die first, which means that Ruth will live for a time not with Naomi, with nobody around her, in this land. She didn't say, hey, when you die, then I'll go back to Moab. No, I'm committed to be here in this community until I die, even without you, and I will be buried here in this land near you. So I'm covenanting to you, your God, and your community. In your community. It's a powerful declaration of allegiance, of conversion. This is what conversion looks like. It's all in, everything in. Everything's behind me. Everything that I want is in front of me, and I've rejected everything else. I think it's an application for us as we think about conversion, about what our conversion is like, what we're looking for in conversion. You know, it's not simply the rearranging of the mental furniture of the mind. It's like, and some people will present Jesus this way. It's like, you know, as long as you can get the right answer on the day of judgment, pray a prayer today, get Jesus someplace in there, so on the day of judgment, when God asks you, why should I let you in, roll the deck, Jesus! I got the right answer. Like it's a quiz, the cosmic quiz. No, it's not simply rearranging that or adding one more piece. Hindus in India, they'd be happy to add Jesus in. We've got 10,000 gods. Oh, we got one more? Yeah, we just pop it in there. You say, no, that's not true conversion. The utter allegiance given unto Jesus Christ. Everything gets forsaken. This is a challenge for us as believers as well. The challenges of allegiance. Allegiance to Jesus will bring opposition and hatred. People will hate you for this allegiance to Jesus. Jesus said this. They have a good authority. Jesus said this himself. John 15:19. He says this, if you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of the world, because of this, the world hates you. And we hear the word choose, and we think, yeah, we're reformed people. We love chosen the doctrine of election in, because of what we're elected unto, good, glorious things, unto Christ, unto fellowship with God. But he also says the dark side of that is that because I chose you, the world hates you. Consider your allegiance to Jesus Christ. There's also the issue of allegiance and how the world tempts us to go back. What these words in 1 John 2:15-17, do not love the world, nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father, but is from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lust. But the one who does the will of God abides forever. So don't love the world, John is saying. I had to imagine that at some point, maybe 5 days later, after this great confession, Ruth may have thought, what have I done? What did I say? What am I getting into? Right? I think that because she's not perfect. She is faithful. There's a distinction. We're not going to be perfect. There are no perfect Christians. But you can be a faithful Christian. Even faithful Christians get tempted by the world, which is why we need the Word of God. Do not love the world. It's a challenge for our allegiance. But we see in Ruth's confession what utter allegiance looks like. It's a glorious thing. It's what we look for in others, that they would come to know Christ. In verses 19 through 21 then, verse 19, so they both went until they came to Bethlehem. And when they had come to Bethlehem, all the city was stirred because of them. And the women said, is this Naomi? She's been gone a while. It's been at least 10 years because they were married 10 years in Moab. And so look, she probably looks, you've seen somebody who's gone through tough life. So now they've had a hard life. They look haggard and worn down. Is this Naomi? Yeah. The idea is some commentators recommend that her husband Elimelech and her, there was probably more of a, they're probably a well-off family that had the ability to even move. And so they come back and it's like, is this Naomi? Is this who left out? This way? And so what we have now, we've seen Ruth's confession. Now we have Naomi's confession. Here it is in verses 20 through 21. She said to them, do not call me Naomi. Naomi means pleasant. Do not call me pleasant. Call me Mara. The word Mara means bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? You might think, well, that's not as glorious a confession as Ruth's confession. It was so powerful and glorious and faith-filled. And yet I think this is a lament infused with a deep understanding of the sovereignty of God. A lament infused with a deep understanding of the sovereignty of God. Naomi sees God's hand in the suffering. Now, she never charges Yahweh with sin. Like, what are you doing? She doesn't forsake him, rebuke him, speak ill of him. We don't sometimes like, well, but as the Almighty is afflicting me. What else? Who else is there? In her understanding, one author has said this, Naomi's theology here is quite sophisticated, anticipating the book of Job. Think of Job. Now, with Job, we actually get a little backstory. We know there's this other being there, the accuser, the adversary, that's doing some stuff under God, under Yahweh's sovereignty. He's still active. But Job doesn't know that. He knows that the Lord is afflicting him. Now, Job has bad allies. His wife says, curse God and die. Not exactly the stuff you need to hear. His friends are like giving him, hey, you've got a problem. You're full of sin. Naomi has Ruth. She doesn't do any of that for her. So this deep theology of recognizing God's sovereignty in the midst of her pain. The Lord has done this. Sophisticated theology, but there is still pain. And we don't like that part. We want to move so fast to the end of Ruth. Let's get by that. We can read these two verses in, 5, 10 seconds? Let me get to the end of the story. I know the end of the story. It's a good story. It's a happy story. We like those. I think of the philosopher and theologian John Feinberg. John Feinberg did his specialization in his studies on the problem of evil. He did a master's thesis on the book of Job, did another master's in theology on the issue of God's sovereignty and free will, then did a PhD thesis on the problem of evil, the philosophical problem of evil, wrote a big fat book called The Many Faces of Evil on the problem of evil, answering these cognitive problems, and then evil touched his life in a profound way. His wife Patricia was diagnosed or was revealed that she had Huntington's disease. The physical symptoms are these. There's a gradual loss of control of all voluntary bodily movements, but it's a psychological toll that might even be worse. Memory loss, depression can lead to hallucinations and paranoid schizophrenia, so the loved one doesn't even recognize those who love her most and are caring for her in this case. And this happens to him. He said this, I thought that as long as one had intellectual answers that explained why God allowed evil in the world, as long as one could point to specific benefits that might accrue in the life of the sufferer would be satisfied. When I saw others struggle over their relationship with God because of some tragedy, I naively thought if I could just offer them some answers, that would resolve everything. Feinberg goes on to talk about his own spiral in the midst of this, as they find this and have to navigate through this Huntington's disease. He speaks of his hopelessness, his helplessness, his sense of abandonment, his anger at God, his confusion. And he reflects on this fact. He says, all the stuff I've written didn't help me one bit. He says this, if anyone had thought about this and was prepared to face affliction, surely it was I. And yet when the events I have recounted happened, I found little comfort in any of it. I had all these intellectual answers, but none of them made any difference in how I felt. The emotional and psychological pain was unrelenting, and the physical results from the stress and mental pain were devastating. He goes on, all my study and all the intellectual answers were of little help because the religious problem of evil isn't primarily an intellectual problem, but is fundamentally an emotional problem. People wrestling with evil as I was do not need an intellectual discourse on how to justify God's ways to man in light of what's happening. That's what's needed to answer or solve the abstract theological, philosophical problem of evil. This, on the other hand, is a problem about how someone experiencing affliction can live with this God who doesn't stop it. And we find ourselves in those places. If you haven't, some of you are living that place right now. If you haven't, you will. That's just a lot of life. You need to know that as a Christian. Some of you are living in that moment, feeling that exact thing. And again, we so desperately want to get to the end of the book, rather than sit here in this place. We somehow think this doesn't count. What counts is the happy ending. But this also is part of what is the Christian life. To recognize that deep theology that we might have, or whatever depth we have, and yet deep pain. He goes on to write of things that did not help him. He says people would come to him and say, you know, you're a Calvinist. That should be of comfort to you because God's going to work all things for your good. So it didn't feel that way. Other people would come to him and say, the problem is that you're a Calvinist. If you'd simply relinquish that thing, you know, you'd be better off if that your problem would be solved, or at least be more solvable. So that didn't help. People flapping on, well, Romans 8:28 is the glorious good promise. But it can be so often misused. I've been in hospital rooms where children have cancer and somebody comes in not knowing what to say. And so they say, God's doing this. God's got a purpose in this. And it rang hollow. And you can just see it in the parents' faces, even though they believe that. And that was the truth that would eventually get them through. But in that moment, he writes of things that did help. He mentions community. People sometimes just saying, I just want to sit with you. I don't know what to say. I can't understand what you're feeling, the depths. But I'll be here for you today and tomorrow. I'll be here with the meal. I'll be here. I'm not going anywhere. Because sometimes we want to leave, right? Friends that are down, they're depressed. Man, I don't want to be around them all the time. But they need community. We need community. The other thing he said helped was finding grace and hope in daily things. To watch for God's grace in just the daily things in front of him, rather than the big answer that might come. And what's fascinating is we're going to see these things, community and finding grace and hope in the daily things in the book. As we're going to read through the rest of the story, those things play a part in the movement of the story. So we know the end. We know the end of Ruth. It's a happy story. Matter of fact, we as Christians, we know the end of the Bible. We know that the living God, Christ himself, will take away every tear. He's going to conquer. There'll be no more death. He's going to win. And yet right now, there is death. Right now, we do suffer. Right now, we do hurt. And sometimes we want to move past these Mara moments, as I call them, these places of bitterness and pain. There is a place for lament. There's a place for lament. I think we need Ruth's confession, the glorious allegiance. We need Naomi's confession. We might learn how to lament. There's a place for lament, but there is hope. Verse 22. So Naomi returned, and with her Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. Naomi had just said, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. I went out full, I've come back empty. That wasn't quite right. she came back, in verse 22 says, she came back with Ruth. She didn't expect there'll be that person that might be a part of her hopeful journey. And that's often the case with us, isn't it? Sometimes we look around, it's like, I've not seen the big answer. Sometimes we might miss what might be around us in relationships, in this case, in relationship with God himself, in the subtle ways. So we're going to see how this subtly works out through the book of Ruth. She wasn't empty. She had Ruth. We're not empty. Feels like it. It feels like it. But we're not. And this is only the beginning of the story. Let's pray.